Blog Talk Radio.
Thanks. Mojuba Akoda, Mojuba Asheda, Mojuba Aluami, Apolabi Pega, Mojuba Arabami, Adesanya Awuyade, Mojuba Ogute Compound Oje Remo, Mojuba Baba, Mojuba Yeye, Mojuba Egun to all the God children, Mojuba Egun to all the Babalawos, the Ears, Mojuba Egungun to all the chiefs, Mojuba Egungun to all the Awos, Mojuba Egungun to all those that are listening, who are tuned in. We give praise and thanks to the Most High. We say Ashe, 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 Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe,
Ashe, Ashe. Welcome to Sign of the Times, everyone. This is Queen Ty here. Sign of the Times is brought to you by the UAC, New Tire Radio Network, Manhood Racing Culture, Unity Design, AAE Society, and last but not least, the Free Ohio Movement. We ask you please support our sponsors. Manhood Racing Culture can be found on the World Wide Web at manhoodraceculture.com. You also can look on Facebook and look for Dr. James Jones, as James Jones, as well as Manhood Race and Culture on Facebook. Please also hook up with Unity Design. Unity is spelled UNITEE. Harley Gorton is the president and proprietor there. We love and appreciate him so much. Please reach out to him. Doing good things in the Motor City at unitydesign.com, UNITEE. Please reach out to him on the World Wide Web at unitydesign.com, and as well as on Facebook as Harley Gorton. AAE Society, headed up by Laquais Jewell. He will be on the air with us on Friday, so please look out for that conversation. Find out how you can be a part of the gathering and the creation of the first black treasury that I know of in the United States. So doing some exciting work with the AAE Society. Please look them up on the World Wide Web at AAEsociety.com. Also, Free Ohio Movement, you can find us at freeohiomovement.org. We're on Facebook as well as the Free Ohio Movement and Mothers, Families, and Friends of the Free Ohio Movement. So I think I covered everybody. I appreciate you all's patience with me tonight as we have a listen and learn session featuring a reading of the book called The FBI War on Tupac and Other Black Leaders by John Potash, and I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly. So I'm going to go ahead and open up Miss Linda real quick, and then we're going to get this party started. Peace, Mother Linda. How are you doing this evening?
I'm still alive and kicking.
Well, good. You sound good.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. Thank you for the birthday wishes.
So what's the topic for today?
Well, we're actually going to listen in on a reading of a book called The FBI War on Tupac and Other Black Leaders, talking about how intricately, I guess, if you will, the government has been behind the demise of a lot of our black leaders, including Tupac and Asada and Mumia and several others. So I hope you get an opportunity to listen in. Dr. Jones is going to be on tomorrow night with me. He's on Wednesday nights now.
Oh, okay. And I'm one thing I forgot to say. As-salamu alaykum.
Wa alaykum as-salam. Thank you for that greeting.
I'll listen in.
All right, all right. Well, love you, Miss Linda. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, everybody. Please enjoy tonight's broadcast. Tomorrow night we're going to have Dr. James Jones and Ajay Tayembe on with us from New York City. They have some feedback on the movie, Birth of a Nation. I've heard good things and bad things about it, and so I'm interested to hear what it is that they have to say. I have seen the original film, which is about 3.5 hours long, and I thought about playing it tonight, but I don't know if anybody has 3.5 hours to listen in, so... but you can go to YouTube and hear the reading, if you will, of Birth of the Nation, and check it out when you get a chance. So we'll be back tomorrow live with Dr. James Jones and Ajay Tayembe. Thank you for listening, everybody. Thank you, Ms. Linda, for your continued support, and thank you as well to all of the other listeners. So I'm going to give my voice a rest tonight so I can make sure that I'm on and ready for tomorrow. So thank you, everybody. Give us a call if you need us, 330-366-6838. 330-366-6838 is our number. Okay, we'll talk to you soon. Peace, everybody.
The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders by John Potash.
All right, at 6 p.m. in New York City at 99.5 FM, WBAI and WBAI.org.
A new book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, took its author John Potash hundreds of interviews and 12 years to complete. Potash argues the FBI and police intelligence used similar tactics and personnel to target Tupac as they had his Black Panther parents.
And finally tonight, did a special unit of the FBI orchestrate the murder of rap artist Tupac Shakur? Does new evidence support how U.S. intelligence targeted Martin Luther King Jr., Malcolm X, the Black Panthers, Jimi Hendrix, Bob Marley, rappers, and linked ethnic leftists? Potash will be at two book signings this weekend following a sellout in Harlem 2 months ago. WBAI's Evening News asked him what he hopes people will learn from his book.
We're going to be offering a book and DVD. The book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders by John Potash. And the DVD of the same name is going to be offered. The book can be yours for a pledge of $80.
You're listening to WPFW, Washington, D.C., 89.3 FM on your dial.
The subtitle of this book is U.S. Intelligence's Murderous Targeting of Tupac, MLK, Malcolm, Panthers, Hendrix, Marley, Rappers, and Linked Ethnic Leftists. The book includes over 1,000 endnotes referencing over 100 personal interviews the author conducted, hundreds of pages of court documents, and hundreds of pages of FBI and CIA documents. The author obtained many of these through a Freedom of Information Act request. For the sake of legitimacy, it should be said that activist leader Fred Hampton Jr. gave an afterword for the book. Pam Africa, head of the International Friends and Family of Mumia Abu-Jamal campaign, wrote a foreword for the book to which former journalist turned top political prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal contributed. Regarding the Freedom of Information Act, this author paid for what was incidentally said to be over 4,000 pages in Tupac Shakur's FBI file. Here's the Department of Justice letter verifying that payment for these pages. The Department of Justice alleged reasons of national security for only sending 99 pages. Nonetheless, the other collected research and thousands of pages of mostly mainstream newspaper and magazine articles, as well as close to 100 research books and videos, substantiate the theme of this book. The collected research shows that a review of U.S. intelligence's targeting of the Shakur family offers a window into the targeting of key leftist black and ethnic leaders for over four decades. Similar tactics and personnel that were used against both conventional leftist leaders, such as Martin Luther King Jr. and Robert F. Kennedy, were used against more grassroots leaders, such as Malcolm X, Huey Newton, and other Panther leaders. Similar tactics and personnel were also used against leftist musicians, ranging from Harry Belafonte and Jimi Hendrix to Bob Marley and political rap artists. Tupac Shakur's leftist legacy started with his mother, Afeni Shakur, a one-time Black Panther leader of the Harlem, New York chapter. She had married Harlem Black Panther chapter founder Lumumba Shakur. Lumumba's father, Sayuddin Abba Shakur, had been a close associate of Malcolm X. Lumumba, his brother Zaid, and their adopted brother Matulu had joined Malcolm X's Organization of Afro-American Unity shortly before Malcolm X's assassination. Malcolm X had formed this group as an American connection to an organization formed by independent African leaders, the Organization of African Unity. Malcolm X was the only American that these African leaders allowed to attend their meetings. Malcolm X warned these African leaders about the racism of America's top corporation owners and their likely desire to take advantage of the leaders to gain cheap access to their minerals, oil, and other resources. This led the African leaders to reconsider $100 million deals with these exploitative companies, which was a leading motive to the company owners possibly ordering Malcolm X's assassination. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale had organized with groups working with the Revolutionary Action Movement, or RAM, in 1966. RAM had started a Black Panther Party in Philadelphia, New York, and then Los Angeles. Maxwell Stanford, seen here, and Herman Ferguson started RAM. They used the Panther symbol that Stokely Carmichael had used for his Lowndes County, Mississippi Freedom Party. Carmichael and H.Rap Brown headed the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, or SNCC, which acted as the student arm of Martin Luther King's group. By October of 1966, Huey Newton and Bobby Seale decided to start their own new group, the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, in Oakland, California. They wanted to differentiate themselves from RAM's Black Panther Party by using more militant means of defending themselves and other blacks against rampant police brutality. They brought guns and law books to scenes of police beating on blacks. They read the rights of the victims and legally pointed guns at the officers to make them stop. Governor Ronald Reagan ended up changing the law because of them. They also developed a 10-point plan that involved free health care for all, free and black-centered education for all, amongst other ideas to fix society's ills. They further enacted these plans by attaining contributions from neighborhood businesses to fund the free breakfast programs and health centers they started. Their fame, membership, and programs quickly spread across the country. The next biggest chapter soon arose in Los Angeles, headed by John Huggins and apprentice Bungie Carter. New York Times best-selling author Eldridge Cleaver had joined the Oakland Black Panther national leadership as their Minister of Information. His soon-to-be wife Kathleen Cleaver gained the position of National Secretary of Communications, a national spokesperson for the group at many events. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale signed Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown as honorary East Coast Black Panther leaders. In New York City, Abba Shakur joined the Revolutionary Action Movement's New York Black Panthers. In 1968, the Oakland-based Black Panther Party for Self-Defense assigned Lumumba Shakur to head the Harlem Black Panthers. Within months, Tupac Shakur's mother, Afeni Shakur, joined the Harlem chapter and then married Lumumba Shakur. The National Panther leadership had assigned Lumumba's childhood friend, Sekou Odinga, who had also joined Malcolm X's group before he died, to head the Bronx Black Panther chapter. They named Lumumba's brother, Zaid Shakur, as the Bronx Black Panther's Minister of Information. Tupac's uncle Thomas McCreary helped lead the Brooklyn Panthers. U.S. intelligence attacks on the Black Panther Party for Self-Defense started in 1967. Police had a list of Black Panther member license plates when they pulled Huey Newton over and got into a shootout with him. Bullets killed one officer and wounded Newton. Courts eventually acquitted Newton of this charge, but not before several years in jail and worldwide protests over his imprisonment. In 1968, a gunman assassinated civil rights leader Martin Luther King Jr. Dr. King's friend, a journalist named William Pepper, later became an attorney teaching at Oxford University and spent over 20 years investigating MLK's assassination. Here he is seen with Dr. King's family, where he represented them at an historic 1999 trial they won against a government co-conspirator involved in King's assassination. William Pepper wrote a first book on the investigation, Orders to Kill, and a second book on the trial, Active State. Pepper said that U.S. intelligence, meaning the CIA, the FBI, military intelligence, etc., orchestrated Martin Luther King's assassination with the help of local mafia. Pepper said they did this partly due to King's mobilization of poor and working class people to struggle for better wages and to oppose the Vietnam War. Some of Pepper's evidence included a copy of orders a Special Forces Group sniper, or Green Beret, gave him, seen here. This backup sniper, ready to finalize the assassination if the first shooter missed, separately confirmed another backup sniper's account. Another piece of evidence is this photo of a reported CIA agent jumping down from where the bullets came several minutes after the assassination. Here's an FBI counterintelligence program called COINTELPRO document detailing U.S. intelligence's concern that another radical black leader could rise up in the way Malcolm X had. The document talks of preventing the rise of a messiah who could unify and electrify the militant black nationalist movement. The document said that Martin Luther King Jr. was the leading candidate for this role. While most people seem to understand that MLK was not a militant black nationalist, but a leader who fought racist institutions, MLK evolved to struggle for economic and social justice. Malcolm X had also evolved to become more inclusive of all races in his movement for social and economic justice. In the days following MLK's assassination, people rioted, setting fire to buildings in over 100 cities nationwide. In Oakland, the highest per capita black city of that time, people didn't set the town ablaze because Black Panthers, including Eldridge Cleaver and Kathleen Cleaver, had asked them not to. They said police would use rioting as an excuse to kill the Black Panthers. Police had ransacked Eldridge and Kathleen Cleaver's home previously and then went after Eldridge 4 days after MLK's assassination. Police used a different excuse to go after Eldridge Cleaver, saying they were looking for a random gunman in the area and he was a suspect. Cleaver eluded them by hiding in the basement of his neighbor's house. Police unloaded a fusillade of bullets into that house. Cleaver saved himself by coming out of the house completely naked, knowing police couldn't shoot him and say he was armed. 18-year-old Bobby Hutton was too shy to follow Cleaver's advice. He came out shirtless, with his arms raised, and police fatally shot him. FBI documents obtained years later and shown here described how they instructed police intelligence to use a harassment arrest strategy to drain the Revolutionary Action Movement's members' time and money. Other documents showed how they used this in their attempt to neutralize the Black Panther Party for self-defense. Evidence further suggested the future use of this strategy against Tupac Shakur and other political rappers. Police intelligence, who had officers that were also FBI agents, proceeded to arrest Panther leaders throughout the country on what appeared as frame-ups. Undercover agents also infiltrated the Black Panthers to set up murders of Panther leaders. These included Los Angeles Panther leaders Bunchy Carter and John Huggins. Huggins and Carter had left a tape-recorded message that if they died, Geronimo Pratt should take their place as the L.A. Panther leader. In Chicago, the FBI and police intelligence waged a particularly gruesome attack on Panther leader Fred Hampton. Hampton had great success in uniting the Panthers in a rainbow coalition with the White Students for a Democratic Society and the Latino Young Lords activist groups. Hampton further helped politicize the largest gangs in Chicago, including the Blackstone Rangers. An undercover police agent, William O'Neill, sabotaged the Blackstone Rangers' merge with the Panthers by firing at the gang and passing fake letters to the Rangers. U.S. intelligence would similarly target Tupac Shakur for his work at politicizing gangs. By the end of 1969, police led a murderous raid on Fred Hampton's apartment. Evidence suggests undercover agent O'Neill drugged Hampton and police killed the Panther leader in his sleep. Police also killed Southern Illinois Panther leader Mark Clark in that raid. Here, some of these Chicago police officers are seen smiling while carrying Hampton's body. Since these assassinations, several federal officials confirmed that the FBI orchestrated them through police intelligence units. For example, a Los Angeles FBI counterintelligence program agent named M. Wesley Swearingen published this memoir, FBI Secrets, in the mid-1990s. It confirmed the FBI's orchestration of L.A. Panther leaders Bunchy Carter and John Huggins' murders. He further confirmed the frame-up of L.A. Panther leader Geronimo Pratt. Swearingen also quoted the Chicago FBI Kill and Tell Pro head as stating their setup of Hampton and Clark's assassinations. FBI agent Swearingen stated in interviews that the FBI's counterintelligence program continued for decades under different names. CIA whistleblowers such as Phil Agee and John Stockwell also confirmed the CIA's consistent aid of these programs into the present. In 1969, U.S. intelligence also had first shot at Bronx Black Panther leader Sekou Odinga and then arrested 21 of the top New York Panthers, including Harlem Panther leader Lumumba Shakur and his wife Afeni Shakur. The Panther 21 decided that collected bail money should first free Afeni Shakur to be the Panthers' Harlem leader and New York spokesperson. Afeni became pregnant with Tupac during that time, just before her bail was revoked. The Panther 21 trial was one of the most highly publicized trials of the decade. Several books were published about what turned into a tragicomic event, including a National Book Award winner. While very pregnant, Afeni Shakur represented herself in court. New York University professor Peter Zimroth, a former prosecutor, observed the whole trial and wrote about the incredible bias the judge showed in favor of the prosecution, including daily meetings the judge had with the prosecutor to coach him on gaining a conviction. In another display of bias, the judge consistently said, "request denied," to any objections Afeni raised, as she legally represented herself in court. At one point, Afeni stood up and asked, "may we ask the district attorney to cooperate in having a just trial?" "Request denied," the judge snapped, leading the pro-Panther crowd filling the courtroom seats to both laughter and jeers. Professor Zimroth quoted jurors who said that Afeni's defense gained all of the Panther 21's acquittals. As the lead juror said, "not guilty for so many counts against the Panther 21, Afeni sobbed in her hands, and many in the court cried with her. Another important aspect of the Panther 21 trial came out when defense attorney Gerald Lefcourt cross-examined the state's witness, undercover agent Eugene Roberts, who had infiltrated the New York Black Panthers and helped frame the Panther 21. Lefcourt said, "Isn't it a fact that you helped murder Malcolm X?" Roberts had previously infiltrated Malcolm X's group and was the first person to arrive at his bullet-ridden body. Malcolm's wife, Betty Shabazz, a nurse, first covered her kids when the shooting started. Then, Joan Roberts grabbed Betty Shabazz, but Shabazz threw her into a wall and ran to her husband, where Gene Roberts said he was dead. William Pepper said that similar to the role of Roberts, undercover military agent infiltrator Merrill McCullough was the first to arrive at Martin Luther King's body at his assassination, as seen here. Pepper said McCullough checked out Martin Luther King's life signs. He then apparently signaled the shooters to disengage as the assassination was successful. Shortly after, McCullough received a promotion to the CIA. Afeni Shakur gave birth to Tupac Amaru Shakur within 2 months of the trial's end in June of 1971. She named him after the last Incan leader to die trying to fight off the Spanish invaders. She eventually moved in with Lumumba Shakur's adopted brother, Mutulu Shakur. Here Mutulu is seen with Tupac Wright from the book Tupac Resurrection. Mutulu was a co-founding member of the Republic of New Africa, the RNA. The RNA started from a convention of black activists nationwide who met in the Detroit church where the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, had grown up, as her father was the minister there. Afeni continued working on activist projects, such as a landmark lawsuit against the New York Police Department. Afeni and other activists, such as Abby Hoffman and lead lawyer Barbara Hanshew, partly based their lawsuit on FBI documents that activists attained by burglarizing an FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania. The documents revealed the FBI's counterintelligence program, or COINTELPRO. The FBI had illegally spied on, infiltrated, sabotaged, and orchestrated murders of people involved in legal protest activities. The FBI used particularly brutal COINTELPRO tactics against black activists such as the Black Panthers. Reports state that the FBI continued to follow Afeni Shakur from job to job and pressured employers to fire her or not to hire her. Mutulu had attained a 4-year degree in acupuncture in Canada. He used it as assistant director of Lincoln Detox, a pioneering program with great success at treating addicts in the South Bronx through acupuncture. Many activists from various groups worked with Mutulu. These included white former Students for a Democratic Society activists, including those linked to the Weather Underground, Puerto Rican independence activists, and former Black Panthers. As Mutulu remained active in the Republic of New Africa, he and Afeni took young Tupac to many activist meetings during those years. Other Shakurs experienced trials and tribulations in the 1970s. Lumumba and Mutulu's brother, Zaid Shakur, had been a tireless Black Panther organizer, while Lumumba and Afeni awaited trial. Zaid worked particularly hard at countering the FBI's COINTELPRO tactics used to divide Black Panther co-founder Huey Newton, based in California, from other Panther leaders, including Eldridge Cleaver, who started a Panther chapter in Algeria. As seen in these FBI strategy documents, further fake letters and undercover agents were used to couple Afeni's New York Panthers with Cleaver in this Newton-Cleaver split. Panther National Secretary Kathleen Cleaver said that some media dubbed this split the East Coast versus West Coast Black Panther War. With similar tactics found, the similar name as the East versus West Rap War appeared more than a coincidence. Amidst that conflict, undercover agent infiltrators reportedly convinced Newton to expel L.A. Panther leader Pratt, Tupac's godfather. Pratt is seen here with his wife Linda, Afeni, Tupac, and Tupac's sister Sechua. They reportedly brought a false background poster into Pratt's prison for this picture. L.A. FBI COINTELPRO leader Richard Held had orchestrated a police raid of the L.A. Panther office in 1969. Police snipers shot up Pratt's bed in that raid, but Pratt saved himself by sleeping on the floor due to a bad back acquired as a Vietnam veteran. Richard Held then framed Pratt for murder in 1970. Through the 70s, Mutulu Shakur's Lincoln Detox reportedly had great success at battling addiction. Before the end of the decade, The mayor's office forced Lincoln Detox to close, possibly due to its political education component. By around 1980, some activists resorted to robbing banks to raise money for healthcare needs in the South Bronx. In 1981, an armored truck robbery resulted in the death of a police officer. The FBI blamed Matula Shakur and other former Lincoln Detox employees, leading many to go into hiding that year. Matulu tried to show his face to his stepson, Tupac, every now and then for encouragement. The FBI visited Tupac in school, asking him if he had seen Matulu. Police also accused Matulu of helping break Tupac's aunt Asada Shakur from jail. Asada had joined Matulu's brother, Zaid Shakur, in the clandestine Black Liberation Army. Police pulled their car over in New Jersey, and a shootout ensued. A police officer and Zaid Shakur were killed. Asada now lives in political exile in Cuba. Matulu had apparently hid with the aid of his brother, Lumumba Shakur, who was murdered around the time of Matulu's arrest in 1986. Concluding Matulu's trial, the sitting judge, Charles Haight, stated that the FBI used COINTELPRO tactics to violate Matulu's rights in the late 1970s. Matulu said that with extensive electronic surveillance, no tape-recorded evidence linked him to the Brinks truck robbery and murder. No fingerprints were found on any immovable objects in 12 houses checked as to where the FBI purported the crime was planned. U.S. intelligence had used this case to arrest dozens of activists throughout New York State and beyond. Despite 115 witnesses and 532 exhibits, virtually the entire case rested on a paid government informant who actually committed the murder of the Brinks truck guard. Paid informant usually means undercover infiltrating agent. The government sentenced that informant to 6 years in jail and released him after 6 months. Matulu was only convicted of conspiracy to aid bank expropriation, not the actual crime. He received 60 years imprisonment with a recommendation of no parole. Black Liberation Army member Sekou Odinga and other underground activists such as Kathy Boudin and Marilyn Buck also received decades-long prison terms. And finally, Dr. Alan Berkman, a longtime activist, became the first doctor since the time of Lincoln's assassination to be imprisoned for providing medical aid to a fugitive. Agents in other reports noted how, despite that the FBI purported to eliminate its counterintelligence program in 1971, the FBI continued it under different names. For example, in this court document, Judge Charles Haight found that police intelligence continued such tactics against the Black Liberation Movement's WLIB radio in the 1980s. After Matulu had gone underground, Afeni moved her kids from house to house trying to get shelter. With the FBI helping block her employment, she was impoverished and desperate while still participating in activist projects. A drug dealer named Legs McNeil entered her life at this vulnerable time and, according to one interview of Afeni, stuck a crack pipe in her mouth whenever she came home at night. Researchers found a number of instances when U.S. intelligence likely used the tactic of placing an undercover agent in activists' life to manipulate them. For example, the head of the Vietnam Veterans Against the War found out his lover worked for U.S. intelligence to sabotage his work. Police intelligence also placed an undercover agent near Malcolm X's daughter, Kabila Shabazz, who helped frame her for conspiring to murder Louis Farrakhan, allegedly for his involvement in her father's assassination. Also, former Black Panther Lilu Lee produced the documentary All Power to the People. He cited U.S. intelligence's use of this tactic versus Huey Newton. The documentary includes many Black Panther leaders stating their belief that U.S. intelligence inserted an undercover agent lover into Huey Newton's life to manipulate him when he got out of jail in 1970. Researchers support that this lover and other undercover agent infiltrators convinced Newton to expel many Panthers, including Geronimo Pratt. Meanwhile, Tupac grew up with an extended family of Black Panther mentors, including Bronx Panther leader Sekou Odinga's wife, Yasmin Fula, seen here with Tupac and her son, Yafu Fula. Yafu later became Tupac's backup singer, Yak, a.k.a. Gaddafi, in the Outlaws rap group. Tupac starred in a play in Harlem and wrote rap songs, but when Harlem Reverend Herb Daughtry asked 13-year-old Tupac what he wanted to be when he grew up, Tupac said, "A revolutionary." Tupac kept to all of his ambitions. By 1984, Afeni moved her family down near Cousins in Baltimore, Maryland. She fought to get Tupac into the Baltimore School for the Arts. Tupac excelled there and met lifetime friend Jada Pinkett, who later found success in Hollywood and also married actor Will Smith. At this time, Tupac attended meetings of the New African Panthers, the young adult group of the New African People's Organization, or NAPO. One of Tupac's lifetime mentors, former RAM-based L.A. Black Panther Watani Tayahimba, was a co-founding national security director of NAPO. By the end of Tupac's junior year of high school, several crack-related murders occurred in the Shakur's neighborhood. That summer of 1988, Afeni decided to move the family to Oakland and stay with Geronimo Pratt's wife, Linda Pratt. Before the end of Tupac's senior year of high school, the New African Panthers elected Tupac as their youngest ever national chairman. According to Tupac, the group attempted to replicate his mother's Black Panthers without making the same mistakes. NAPO national chairman Chokwe Lumumba set Tupac at the top sales of NAPO's newspaper by any means necessary in California. Tupac started a newspaper insert, Panther Power, for his group. Both NAPO and the New African Panthers were active in 8 cities at that time. Tupac had also been rapping, doing musical benefits for his imprisoned godfather, Geronimo Pratt. He also said he was strategizing with both Pratt and the Black Panther Minister of Defense, which was Panther co-founder Huey Newton's title. Authorities had imprisoned Newton on a small charge in 1988 and incidentally put him in prison with Pratt at San Quentin. Pratt took Newton under his wing. The two compared their government files their lawyers had helped them obtain, and it ended the split the FBI and CIA had started against them. Here's an older picture of Pratt welcoming Newton when he first got out of prison in 1970, before Pratt's expulsion. When authorities released Newton from prison on August 22, 1988, he refused to leave and instead held a press conference the following day. This officially ended the FBI's 18-year split of two key leaders. Pratt convinced Newton to leave and work for his release on the outside. It appeared more than coincidence that exactly 1 year later, on August 22, 1989, gunmen assassinated Newton. Newton organized to release Pratt and talked to East Coast Panthers about reforming the Black Panthers. The FBI's L.A. COINTELPRO leader, Richard Held, had moved back to head the FBI's San Francisco Bay office in 1986. TV news stations caught him lying when he said they had no suspects, and witnesses described it as an execution rather than a random drug death. Martin Luther King's family lawyer, William Pepper, reported that they used this kind of threat timing tactic when they assassinated Martin Luther King on the anniversary of MLK's Riverside speech, officially coming out against the Vietnam War on April 4, 1967. By 1990, Tupac Shakur decided to leave his New African Panther leadership to tour with the Grammy-nominated rap group Digital Underground. Here, Tupac's seen with Digital Underground on stage. He had already recorded an album's worth of songs in 1989, which a Digital Underground member found and produced in the late 1990s, titled The Lost Tapes. It included a song titled after his New African Panthers newspaper insert, Panther Power. The song's lyrics included lines such as, "Couldn't survive in this capitalistic government because it was meant to hold us back with ignorance. Drugs and sneak attacks in my community, they killed our unity." Here he had started writing songs with political terminology. He soon decided to keep political ideas in his lyrics, but gave up the terminology, apparently to not lose less educated fans. In 1990, Earth First environmental leader Judy Barry had launched the Redwood Summer Campaign to fight the destruction of the Redwood Forest from her San Francisco Bay Area office. Her successes had repercussions. A logging truck rammed into her car in 1989, nearly killing Barry and her kids. Someone had also nailed this picture of Barry playing a violin on her door, with rifle crosshairs over her and dog feces on it. Researchers stated that this was a known U.S. intelligence warning tactic. In 1990, a bomb went off under her car seat. She was paralyzed and died within another 6 years. The FBI first investigated Judy Barry and a passenger in Barry's car, Daryl Cherney, for planning to use a bomb themselves. After much protest, the FBI said they were looking for the perpetrator. Barry, known as Queen of the Quip, began to realize the FBI's corrupt attacks on protesters. At a news conference, she told the press, "I hope the FBI find their man, and when they do, I hope they fire him." Barry and Earth First filed a lawsuit against FBI Area Chief Richard Held and key police leaders. The suit eventually gained enough powerful support that it forced Richard Held into an early retirement in 1993. In the years before Held's retirement, several key attacks occurred on Tupac Shakur as he broke into the music world, leading Tupac to say, "I never had a record until I made a record." As Tupac's fame and wealth increased, promising more power and money behind his radical political agenda, the complexity of the attacks on him increased. First, Tupac landed a solo record deal for Tupacalypse Now that resulted in a worldwide MTV video release in October of 1991. Within several days, Oakland police stopped Tupac for jaywalking. As described in these official legal claim pages, police banged his head into a curb and choked him unconscious. News articles have reported at least two other cases where suspects have died in police hands from those same police actions. Tupac had already hired his New African People's Organization mentor, Watani Tayahimba, to work as his business manager. He hired NAPO National Chair Chokwe Lumumba to be his national legal consultant and to represent him on the police brutality case, in which he won a large settlement from the government. This funding of a national radical black organization's leadership gave the FBI even more reason to target Tupac. Within a year, Tupac had a debut lead role in the major motion picture Juice, which had its premiere in San Francisco. That night, Tupac experienced a drive-by shooting on his and his friend's limousine as they traveled from the movie theater to the after-party. The similar timing appears more than coincidental. More evidence of FBI Supervisor Richard Held's orchestration comes by way of witnesses catching plainclothes California police officers using an unmarked car to attempt a drive-by shooting of a police brutality witness in the 1990s. As Tupac's fame and fortunes rose, police attacks on the rap and film star increased. Tupac next starred in John Singleton's sophomore film, Poetic Justice, as the co-lead with Janet Jackson. Tupac's first CD, Tupacalypse Now, had gone gold, and his career was soaring. On August 22, 1992, the three-year anniversary of Huey Newton's assassination, the most complex attack on Tupac occurred. At the Marin Festival in the San Francisco Bay Area, Tupac came as an honorary guest. As Tupac signed autographs for kids, a man amongst a group of strangers ran up to Tupac and punched him for no reason. Tupac's road manager and Matula Shakur's son, Maurice Moprim Harding, blocked others in the group from attacking Tupac. Harding took a gun out and shot it straight towards the sky before he and Tupac took off running. Witnesses supported that at least one of the strangers fired his gun at Tupac, all in front of police, who failed to intervene or arrest the shooters. One of the bullets hit a boy nearby, but police only arrested Tupac and Harding, though they let them go with no charges when witnesses exonerated them. 3 months later, Vice President Dan Quayle denounced Tupac's debut CD in a nationally reported speech. Tupac had finished his second CD, Strictly for My N-I-G-G-A-Z, in 1992, but his record label, Interscope, failed to release it. Tupac used this variation on the N-word as an acronym for Never Ignorant Getting Goals Accomplished in an attempt to reverse its negativity. Time Warner had a 25% stake in Interscope Records, and after Tupacalypse Now went gold, Time Warner bought another 25% share, gaining a dominant voice in the company. They then refused to release Tupac's second CD for another year. As the largest media company in the world, both Time and Warner had a history of supporting Republican candidates and conservative causes. For example, Time Incorporated's Vice President Charles Douglas Jackson rotated back and forth as an architect for the CIA heading their psychological warfare division for various presidents, and running Time magazine's empire. British editor Francis Stoner Saunders, whose book The Cultural Code War is seen here, went through C.D. Jackson's letters, which showed that he ran many of these operations through Time's magazines. These operations included targeting black musicians. This suggests that Time Warner refused to release Tupac's second CD because it made fun of President Bush and Vice President Quayle several times, and the presidential elections came up in November. Time Warner also censored many of Tupac's radical songs and videos for that CD. A year before, a court acquitted the white cops who were caught on video beating Rodney King. This acquittal sparked the L.A. riots in 1992. Fred Hampton Jr., the Chicago Black Panther leader's son, organized protests in Chicago. Hampton Jr. led the Illinois chapter of the socialist Uhuru group. Hampton said that one of the same police officers who targeted his father arrested him. He also said that people had made several attempts on his life, as his picture through his shattered car window exemplifies. Police also charged Hampton with arson. The judge said the building police charged Hampton for burning never actually had a fire. Despite that, Fred Hampton Jr. received many years in jail. When he was released, Fred Hampton formed the Prisoner of Conscience Committee, a nationwide activist group. Events around the LA riots also led Tupac Shakur to change his persona. Former Black Panthers and other activists had garnered a gang peace truce between leading Bloods and Crips gang sects in Los Angeles. As seen in this 1994 Los Angeles Times headline, these peace truces started spreading. They eventually went nationwide, and these gangs started turning into community activists. For example, one Crip leader talked at a conference sponsored by a black socialist group called Panther in England. Also, the Latino version of the Black Panthers, the Young Lords, influenced New York's largest gang, the Latin Kings, to participate in this movement. The video, Black and Gold, and the Columbia University Press published book, The Almighty Latin King and Queen Nation, detailed their activist conversion in the mid-1990s. Not long after the early 1990s Blood Crips peace truce, Tupac and one of his mentors had come up with a political plan. Tupac decided to take on a gangster rap persona in order to appeal to gangs and then politicize them. He did this as part of the peace truce movement, participating in a Bloods Crips peace truce picnic and other events. Tupac called this the Thug Life Plan. He and his still-imprisoned stepfather, Matulu Shakur, wrote up a code of thug life, reprinted in Jamal Joseph's book, Tupac Legacy. Joseph, formerly part of the Panther 21, later became director of Columbia University's film program. Joseph was also part of Tupac's extended family of ex-Panther mentors. The Code of Thug Life tried to lessen the harm gangs did to their communities. Matulu eventually brokered a peace truce between the Blood and Crips gangs in the nationwide federal prison system. Tupac's Thug Life plan also attempted to politicize more rappers. Trying to spread the wealth, he formed a temporary rap group called Thug Life that put out a CD in 1994. Matulu's son Maurice Moprim Harding rapped in the Thug Life group. Police retaliated against the gang peace truce movement and Tupac, eventually with some of the same officers. They appeared to start using the same harassment arrest strategy against Tupac that they used against his mother's Black Panthers. Police arrested Tupac for many charges that were dismissed, such as saying he was smoking marijuana in public in a hotel lobby at an Atlanta National Political Rap Convention that had scheduled him to speak. At the next year's Atlanta Rap Convention, they charged him with slapping a woman who asked for his autograph, when witnesses said that the woman had actually started a fight with Tupac's companion, and Tupac just got between them to stop it. Another time in Atlanta, friends drove Tupac from a concert he had given, when witnesses say two off-duty white cops in street clothes were beating on a black motorist in front of the rapper. Tupac rolled down his window to ask what was happening. Both white and black witnesses say the white men then ran at Tupac's car, smashed Tupac's car window with the butt of a gun, and shot at him. Tupac reportedly rolled out of the back left seat and got a security guard's gun. The men started running, partly sideways, with a gun pointed back at Tupac, as they apparently hadn't expected the large group of people in Tupac's envoy to exit their cars to defend Tupac. Tupac had already gotten down on one knee and shot the men several times in the butt, back, and leg. The state used several excuses for dropping their legal case against Tupac for this shooting. Evidence supports that prosecutors actually dropped the case to avoid revealing police intelligence's botched attempt to assassinate new rap and film star Tupac Shakur. The two cops claimed to have been drinking that night, but they also were carrying a gun stolen from an evidence locker with which they shot at Tupac. As seen in a later, unrelated Tupac trial, testimony says that a police detective described such a gun as a throwaway gun. He reported that police use such a gun to drop in someone else's hand or get rid of when they kill someone and don't want the murder weapon traced back to them. The FBI worked closely with Atlanta Police Intelligence in 1993. They admitted collecting thousands of documents in their surveillance of Imam Jamil Al-Amin, who had changed his name from H-Rap Brown. As a student National Coordinating Committee leader and a one-time honorary Black Panther, Brown gave speeches nationwide. An hour after giving a speech in Cambridge, Maryland, two police officers fired shots at Rap Brown, leading blacks in that town to riot. U.S. Congress then passed the Rap Brown Amendment, making it illegal to cross state lines and give a speech that provokes a riot. During the rioting, Maryland police tried to arrest Brown, but his supporters snuck him out. A reporter later asked Brown if the rumors were true that they snuck him out in a coffin. Brown responded, "I've never said. The government probably would have liked me to leave in a coffin." Brown converted to Islam and became Atlanta's imam, or spiritual leader. As Imam Jamil Al-Amin, he headed their council of imams for a sect that included a majority of the world's Muslims. While his group cleared drugs out of neighborhoods, the FBI's undercover infiltrators of his mosque found no wrongdoing. In 1995, a man reported that police coerced him to say Imam Al-Amin shot him. In the later 1990s, much evidence supports that police framed Al-Amin for the murder of a police officer, and he now sits on death row. With the Atlanta police shooting at Tupac Shakur, U.S. intelligence appeared to use an even more sophisticated strategy against Tupac, psychological profiling. Huey Newton had written in his book, War Against the Panthers, how the FBI had used psychological profiling in unsuccessfully trying to assassinate him in the 1970s. In 1981, police shot former Philadelphia Black Panther leader Mumia Abu-Jamal. Jamal had worked as a radio journalist, receiving awards and leading the city's Association of Black Journalists. Mumia's radical journalism caused him to lose higher-paying jobs, so he moonlighted as a taxicab driver. One late night in December, a police officer started beating Mumia's brother, Billy Cook, on the head until he bled within eyesight of Mumia and his cab. Mumia came over to the scene and bullets rang out, leaving the police officer dead and Mumia wounded. Much evidence, including many witnesses and even an affidavit from one of the shooters, support that U.S. intelligence used psychological profiling to lure Mumia to the scene. Police intelligence could then kill Mumia, either there or with a frame-up for murdering the police officer. One of the shooters, a contract killer now in prison for another murder, said that corrupt police and mafia paid him to kill the police officer. He also said that another shooter finished the job and left the scene. Years later, the Village Voice and others quoted several witnesses that corroborated this account. U.S. intelligence had so far succeeded in framing Mumia Abu-Jamal with the murder as he now sits on death row. A longtime court stenographer signed an affidavit attesting to the judge's collaboration with any U.S. intelligence's goals against Mumia. The stenographer said that when she came up to the judge in his chambers before Mumia's case, he said, "I'm going to help them fry the nigger." Acclaimed writers and artists, along with politicians worldwide, have unsuccessfully tried to gain Mumia a new trial, but he can be heard around the world on activist radio stations that play his weekly spoken essays from prison. Mumia Abu-Jamal has also written several widely praised books while incarcerated, such as the one seen here. 2 weeks after police shot at Tupac Shakur, a new so-called friend of Tupac's, set the rapper up on his infamous sexual liaison that landed him in jail. New York Haitian music promoter Jacques Egnant entered Tupac's life as the rap star worked on the set of his third film, Above the Rim. Tupac said constant arrests and what appeared as frivolous lawsuits had drained all of his money. Egnant, also known as Haitian Jack or Nigel, lavished Tupac with clothes and jewelry. Egnant also took Tupac to the most exclusive clubs that even Tupac said he wasn't sure he could gain entrance. At one such club, Jacques Egnant introduced Tupac to a woman who admitted kissing his penis on a dance floor. She then had consensual sex with Tupac that night. Tupac's activist lawyer, Michael Tarif Warren, said that she further left messages on his hotel answering machine saying she wanted to have more sex with Tupac. After the woman charged Tupac and Egnant with forcibly sodomizing her several nights later, police said they accidentally erased this taped evidence. Michael Warren had much experience working against police intelligence. He worked as the European spokesman for the Free Mumia campaign. He had also represented Tupac's stepfather, Matulu Shakur, Pacifico radio journalist, and he had attained the reversal of convictions in the infamous Central Park jogger case. Warren first saw a longtime Police Benevolence Association lawyer bail out Egnant and represent him in court. Warren then attained Egnant's rap sheet that he said had a long list of major crimes up and down the East Coast, all dismissed. Warren said that this was a sure sign of an undercover police intelligence agent. The long trial went very poorly for the prosecutors. For example, police medical investigators reported no sign of forced sex during the incident. Near the last day of the proceedings, the prosecution ended up telling the judge that they had accidentally withheld evidence from the defense attorney and would accept a mistrial. Tupac rejected the offer of a mistrial, wanting to clear his name. The jury found Tupac not guilty of all major charges, including forced sodomy, attempting forced sodomy, assisting forced sodomy, and gun possession. As seen in this court document describing the counts for which the jury had found Tupac guilty, they only found Tupac guilty of touching the woman's butt against her will and for assisting Egnant touching her butt against her will. While the media has wrongfully characterized this conviction as rape or the more vague sexual assault, this court document spells out the actual charge for which prosecutors convicted Tupac. Tupac and the woman agreed that oral sex had occurred, and the judge ruled it consensual. Nonetheless, the judge sentenced Tupac to 1.5 to 4.5 years in prison. Attorney Warren said that prosecutors made a rare exception in allowing Jacques Egnant to sever his case from Tupac's, and they allowed him to settle for just 2 misdemeanors. New Yorker editor Connie Brook wrote a comprehensive article on Tupac Shakur in 1997. She revealed that the district attorney covered up why Egnant received preferential treatment by both the district attorney's office and the purported victim. This and other revelations of government foul play in that article were the likely reasons that the FBI interviewed Connie Brook after her article's publication, as seen in this FBI document. U.S. intelligence appeared to make another attempt to murder Tupac while the jury deliberated this case in November of 1994. An associate of Jacques Egnant had offered a large amount of cash to record a song at a Times Square recording studio. When Tupac entered the lobby, gunmen fired 4 bullets into the rap star, including 2 bullets in his skull, according to the doctor's affidavit seen here. The bullets miraculously missed Tupac's brain. Tupac, seen here carried away on a stretcher, started giving the finger to the media because of the way they constantly misrepresented attacks on him. Much evidence suggests that police intelligence orchestrated this shooting. For example, award-winning journalist Kathy Scott later reported that the security guard said he offered a police security camera videotape of the incident to the police. They refused it and closed the case. At this point in the analysis of U.S. intelligence's murderous targeting of Tupac Shakur and black leaders, it's important to look at the media misrepresentation of these events, noted moments ago. Mainstream media's work for U.S. intelligence has a long history. This history first requires a look at U.S. intelligence's war on ethnic leftists. U.S. intelligence waged the longest war against the American Indians. Their genocidal policies included wars and constant mass displacements, such as the Trail of Tears. When the American Indian Movement, or AIM, arose in the latter half of the 20th century, more sophisticated murderous targeting developed. For example, within hours of AIM leader John Trudell burning a flag on the Capitol steps in the 1970s, someone set his house ablaze, killing his wife and three kids, seen here. The FBI branch of U.S. intelligence started with Attorney General Palmer's Bureau of Information. They led the infamous Palmer raids that rounded up thousands of Italian anarchists and other labor organizers. They notoriously executed Italian anarchist labor organizers Nicola Sacco and Bartolomei Vanzetti, despite global protests about what appeared as a murder frame-up. Palmer's assistant, J. Edgar Hoover, helped change the Bureau's name to the Federal Bureau of Investigation, or FBI, by the 1940s. The FBI later participated in the prosecution of Jewish and purported communists Julius and Ethel Rosenberg in the early 1950s. The Rosenbergs, parents of two small boys, were the only people ever officially executed for treason during peacetime. Similar to the Sacco and Manzetti case, global protests had failed to halt their execution. While the government claimed to execute the Rosenbergs for passing nuclear secrets to the Soviet Union, some evidence supports certain researchers' claims that U.S. intelligence executed them for a similar reason as they executed Sacco and Manzetti. They say U.S. intelligence wanted to make examples of them to scare off other members of these ethnic groups who dominated anti-capitalist labor organizing. Later released government documents found that, similar to the trial of the Panther 21, the judge, prosecutors, and the FBI improperly talked throughout the trial to gain the Rosenbergs' prosecution. By the time of the Rosenbergs' trial, U.S. intelligence had gained a larger umbrella of bigoted, super-rich directors. The National Security Act of 1947 placed the CIA director as supervisor of all other 14-plus intelligence agencies. The highest-level CIA whistleblower, Victor Marchetti, an assistant deputy director, fought with the CIA to publish his censored exposé, The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. He and British editor Francis Stoner Saunders, among others, described the CIA founding leaders as coming exclusively from the wealthiest white Protestant families. The CIA showed its extreme prejudices when they colluded with British intelligence and other European intelligence groups to save many top Nazis. Insiders, such as U.S. Department of Justice prosecutor John Loftus, who led investigations of Nazi war criminals, documented this extensively in books such as The Secret War Against the Jews. Even George W. Bush's administration admitted to saving some 100 Nazis, though more careful researchers report that they saved thousands of Nazis. Through operations such as Paperclip, Sunshine, and Odessa, they shipped them around the world. A particularly large amount of them went to Latin America to gain control of resources there. U.S. officials have claimed to save Nazis to fight communists, but these Nazis actually fought against any form of real democracy. For example, Western intelligence worked with them to carry out many coups against elected leaders in Latin America, amongst other operations. As stated in the caption, this first picture is of a Nazi flag waving in the Andes after a 1980 Bolivian coup. Professor Peter Dale Scott, a former Canadian diplomat and professor at University of California, Berkeley, wrote of how Klaus Barbie, the Butcher of Lyon, seen here, helped orchestrate that coup in Bolivia. Professor Scott also covered how Walter Rauf, seen left, was inventor of the portable gas chamber in his work for Hitler. Rauf then worked as a Chilean torturer for CIA directors such as Alan Dulles, seen right, after aiding the CIA-assisted Chilean coup of elected socialist leader Salvador Allende. This CIA document discusses their work with the coup plotters. The CIA then assisted in Chile-based multinational Operation Condor that assassinated Latin American leftists around the world, according to the New York Times, and detailed in this CIA document. These Nazis also advised U.S. intelligence in their cultural war against democracy at home and abroad. By 1977, Watergate muckraking journalist Carl Bernstein reported on the CIA's work in the media. Despite his fame from Watergate, Bernstein could only publish his article, CIA and the Media, in Rolling Stone magazine. He based his facts on the Congressional Church Committee findings that well over 400 members of the media lived dual lives in their work for the CIA. As seen in this paragraph, this number included the heads of virtually all mainstream news organizations, such as ABC, spelled out here as the American Broadcasting Company, NBC, CBS, the Associated Press, Time Incorporated, etc. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ben Bagdikian, dean of the University of California Berkeley School of Journalism, found other ways the wealthiest families control Americans' information. Besides directing the CIA, the wealthiest families own the most multinational corporations. In his book, The Media Monopoly, Bagdikian detailed how they share boards of directors with the media companies and that, under law, the director of a company is obliged to act in the interest of his or her own company. Thus, oil companies, defense contractors, banks, insurance firms, and pharmaceutical firms who share directors with Time Incorporated, television companies, and big city newspapers should vote to censor information that can affect their profits. For example, Tupac criticized the government in having money for war but they can't feed the poor on a second CD. Defense contracting company General Dynamics shared at least one director with Time Incorporated and would have supported the censorship Time Warner started against Tupac. Another defense contractor, General Electric, had bought NBC Television. And former CIA Director William Casey had the largest ownership in capital cities when they bought ABC. Wharton School of Business professor Ed Herman also wrote the book Manufacturing Consent with MIT professor Noam Chomsky, which analyzed the media business. They revealed other ways U.S. intelligence and the super rich control our information. Herman and Chomsky said that the Armed Forces Journal International revealed in 1971 that the Pentagon published 371 different magazines and journals. This made the Pentagon 16 times larger than the next largest American publisher. By 1982, the number of different Pentagon-published periodicals increased to 1,203. This might explain the magazine section of Barnes & Noble. Carl Bernstein's seminal article titled CIA and the Media took particular note of Charles Douglas Jackson, mentioned previously. Bernstein found agreement with Francis Stoner Saunders, who noted C.D. Jackson's revolving door between heading Time's media empire and many top magazines, and working amongst the CIA's leadership. Saunders reported Jackson's post as the presidential advisor on psychological warfare. In the 1990s, Time merged with Warner Brothers Film Company. They also partnered with music mogul Quincy Jones to start Vibe magazine, likely to give Vibe credibility. Time Warner's limitless money gave it market dominance. While black voices in top magazines showed positive progress, Time Warner appeared to have the goal of negatively influencing black America, the same way they did the rest of America through the dozens of magazines and other media it owned. By 1992, the Los Angeles Times described how Time Warner's vast record label ownership included the great bulk of the rap stars. Advertisers and corporate interests also controlled most other music magazines, leading to further censorship of Tupac's life and times. At the start of 1995, a judge set Tupac Shakur's bail at $3 million and refused Tupac's offer of about $1.2 million. While Tupac resided in Rikers Penitentiary in New York City, his next CD, Me Against the World, opened at number one in the pop music charts. Many reporters interviewed him in jail, and Tupac spoke against the U.S. bombing of Bosnia. Authorities quickly moved Tupac 9 hours north to the maximum security Clinton Correctional Facility in upstate Dannemora, New York. U.S. intelligence likely did this to take away Tupac's media mouthpiece and to begin their use of penal coercion tactics on him. Prison officials worked with U.S. intelligence to damage the mind of political prisoners with these tactics. In this Amnesty International report, they described 8 penal coercion methods, all of which were used on Tupac, including his 10 months in solitary confinement. Guards also used torture tactics on Tupac in sticking their gloved fingers up his rectum. They pretended to look for contraband each time a visitor saw him, despite that a guard monitored these visits. The penal coercion aided what appeared as several U.S. intelligence plans for Tupac. The first plan involved strangers in jail telling Tupac that his friend, fellow rap star Biggie Smalls, a.k.a. Notorious Big, born Christopher Wallace, set up his New York shooting. Tupac also received anonymous letters saying that New York-based Biggie set up his shooting. California-based Tupac started to believe the idea, and the media hyped this as the East Coast versus West Coast rap war. U.S. intelligence successfully manufactured the East Coast versus West Coast Black Panther War using the same tactics versus California-based Black Panther founder Huey Newton and Afeni Shakur's New York Panthers. U.S. intelligence also appeared to have started a front company named Death Row Records in 1992. Death Row made regular, extremely generous offers to Tupac to join them before the rap star landed in prison. Death Row Records owners Suge Knight and Dave Kenner are seen here. Kenner, a white attorney, had made himself the actual power, enlisting himself as CEO of Death Row's umbrella company that he created. Knight is seen standing to the right of Kenner. The two Death Row heads flew from Los Angeles to New York with regularity to get Tupac on their label. In September of 1995, Tupac finally signed a 3-CD contract with them and was released from prison within days. This effectively ended Tupac Shakur's relationship with his top political mentors. His business manager, New African People's Organization Security Director Watani Tayahimba, said Tupac cried on his shoulder, saying he knew he was selling his soul to the devil. Tayahimba said that he and NAPO's national chair, Chokwe Lumumba, Tupac's national lawyer, didn't know exactly what Death Row was, but they knew that they couldn't have any connection with Death Row without risking their whole organization. In his book Dark Alliance, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gary Webb detailed how a top national crack trafficker, Freeway Ricky Ross, had bought his crack from CIA-linked international traffickers. Webb said that Death Row's founder, Michael Hario Harris, was one of Ross's top two associates. Death Row CEO Dave Kenner was Harris's attorney. High-level Los Angeles police detective Russell Poole broke open to the public what his fellow police officers were doing inside Death Row Records. Award-winning filmmaker Nick Broomfield highlighted Poole, reporting his findings in the documentary Biggie and Tupac. Veteran journalist Randall Sullivan wrote his book Labyrinth on Poole and his findings. Detective Poole, seen here at a crime scene, found dozens and dozens of his fellow Los Angeles police officers at all levels of Death Row Records. Poole's superiors told him that these police officers in Death Row Records could be considered troubleshooters or covert agents. Poole found that employees of Death Row trafficked drugs and guns, as well as laundered money. Death Row also helped break up political rap groups, such as NWA. They lured top rap producer Dr. Dre from NWA, and then they got him to stop criticizing marijuana and start promoting it. They also terrorized the political rap conventions that invited Tupac to speak. Death Row further helped instigate the East versus West rap feud. This was the feud that had Tupac in conflict with Biggie and Biggie's producer, Sean Puffy Combs, later known as P. Diddy, seen here. Knight and Death Row also tried to end the Blood versus Crips gang peace truce. While Tupac had worked on furthering the Blood Crips peace truce, Suge Knight instigated fights between Bloods and Crips that he employed. These fights escalated to the point that a Blood gang member working at Death Row murdered a Crip gang member at a small Death Row concert. Despite witness reports, police failed to arrest anyone at this concert. Knight accomplished these actions with his head of security, a former Los Angeles police officer, Reggie Wright Jr. Reggie Wright Sr. headed the Compton area Los Angeles Police Gang Division. Detective Russell Poole ended up resigning from the police force when he said that his superiors blocked his investigation of Death Row Records. Before his resignation, he found that these three police officers played a large part in Death Row's operations. Rafael Perez, seen on the right worked for the Rampart Division's elite undercover crash unit. The Los Angeles Police Department's crash unit participated in Operation Hammer, which conducted regular mass detentions. One such police sweep arrested over 1,400 people at one time for suspected gang activity. Only 32 of those 1,400 detained ended up with an actual charge. Best-selling author Mike Davis, who wrote City of Quartz, said police targeted gang truce leaders and not even testimony from top politicians could stop their long-term imprisonment on reported frame-ups. Davis also said police raided gang truce picnics and dances. One such gang leader turned truce leader, Monster Cody Scott, wrote a best-selling book, Monster, released in 1993, about his conversion to leftist activism. He strategized with Tupac and Matula Shakur before changing his name to Sonika Shakur. Los Angeles police arrested him again in the mid-1990s. Another way Suge Knight appeared to be carrying out U.S. intelligence operations was in terrorizing people in Death Row's studio in front of Tupac. In this and other ways, they appeared to continue the penal coercion tactics used on Tupac in prison. With Death Row, Tupac wrote his most negative lyrics. While in prison, Tupac had vowed to give up smoking weed. Upon leaving prison, Knight and Kenner reportedly gave Tupac much weed and alcohol, leading him to write many of his lyrics high and drunk within 24 hours of his release. Despite the negative lyrics, Tupac's All Eyes on Me double CD became the second fastest-selling album of all time. It went triple platinum in 1996. By the summer of 1996, Tupac fought with Suge Knight, saying he completed his contract when he finished his next CD, released as Machiavelli's Don Caluminati, The 7-Day Theory. Tupac had already started his own record company, Euthanasia, which Yasmin Fula ran. This picture shows Tupac's Euthanasia letterhead and regular payments from the new company to his stepfather Matulu Shakur, his godfather Geronimo Pratt, and his mother Afeni. Afeni was still working for Pratt and Matulu's release from jail. Yasmin Fula was married to imprisoned Bronx Black Panther Sekou Odinga. That summer, Tupac was also settling down, having moved in with his fiancée, Kadeda Jones, music mogul Quincy Jones' daughter. Jones said she and Tupac planned on having a baby, and Tupac had largely given up smoking and drinking at that time. At the end of August, Tupac signaled his exit from Death Row when he fired his Death Row attorney, Dave Kenner. 9 days later, Tupac had planned to attend the Mike Tyson boxing title match in Las Vegas. One of his two personal Death Row bodyguards, Kevin Hackey, tried to get Tupac to back out of going. Hackey later revealed that he was working undercover for the FBI at that time, but apparently turned on the FBI in telling Tupac not to go to Las Vegas. Hackey encouraged Tupac to move near his activist mentors in Atlanta. For that, Death Row fired Hackey. Hackey said that soon after, the FBI set him up on a gun possession charge and imprisoned him for months. Tupac attended the Vegas Tyson fight and headed for a post-fight concert in Knight's car. This is the last picture of Tupac taken minutes before his death. Death Row Security Chief Reggie Wright made the unusual move of keeping guards out of their car, taking guns away from the guards, and giving Tupac's other personal bodyguard a mobile phone without a battery. Gunmen did a fatal drive-by shooting on Tupac. Despite over 13 bullets fired in Knight's direction, not one directly hit him. Kevin Hackey said he had documents to prove that FBI and ATF agents were in Tupac's motorcade and watched his murder. As Tupac lay dying in the hospital, Knight reportedly sent cases of guns to Blood gangs and said the Crips shot Tupac. Many fatal shootings amongst the gangs ended the peace truce until activists spread the word that the Crips likely didn't shoot Tupac. Tupac died at the age of 25. The night of the next Mike Tyson fight, somebody fatally shot Yafu Fula in the head. Fula, seen here, was Tupac's backup singer as part of the Outlaws. He was also Bronx Black Panther founder Sekou Odinga's son and had told Las Vegas police he thought he could identify Tupac's murderer. Vegas police had told the media that there was no forthcoming witnesses. On Tupac's final completed CD, Don Culminati, The 7-Day Theory, he had lyrics discussing Haitian Jack Egnant, saying that he knew he was working for the feds, or the FBI, in setting up his New York frame-up and shooting. This dispelled the notion that Biggie Smalls set up the shooting, effectively ending the East versus West rap war. Tupac also played a radical political speech by Malcolm X on that CD. Tupac left hundreds of songs that Afeni Shakur went on to release as chart-topping albums. 8 months after Tupac's murder, gunmen murdered Biggie Smalls. They conducted a drive-by shooting in Los Angeles in 1997. The Los Angeles Times and other news sources reported that FBI and ATF agents, who also worked for the New York Police Department, had taken pictures of Biggie within minutes of his death. Los Angeles police allowed homicide detective Russell Poole as lead investigator in that case. Detective Poole found overwhelming evidence that his fellow police officers in Death Row Records murdered Biggie. He said that they did this to cover up their murder of Tupac by making it look to be part of the East versus West rap war. Following rapper Dr. Dre, who left Death Row Records a year earlier, rap star Snoop Dogg left Death Row and started meeting with Sean Puffy Combs to quell the rap war. Death Row guards attacked him and Suge Knight threatened his life. Knight further defied the judge's ruling and kept many of Tupac's recordings from Afeni Shakur. One of a few successful actions against U.S. intelligence came in 1997 when Geronimo Pratt's legal team won his freedom after 27 years of imprisonment. A judge declared that the government had falsely imprisoned Geronimo Pratt, who had changed his name to Geronimo G. Jaga. The government offered several $1 million to settle a lawsuit by Geronimo's legal team that included years of legal research help by Afeni and Mutulu Shakur. Police foul play against rappers continued nationwide. Mainstream media reports ended up finding that New York and Los Angeles rap units trained police units nationwide in using FBI counterintelligence program tactics versus rappers. The FBI and ATF, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, became directly involved in targeting New York rap group Wu-Tang Clan, according to a Village Voice article. For example, an undercover agent became one of Wu-Tang Clan's managers as the FBI explored bringing gun charges against the rap group. Undercover police also attempted to murder Wu-Tang Clan lead singer ODB, while ODB's brother had the group working with top Brooklyn activist Sonny Carson. The Miami Herald and other mainstream news sources eventually reported that New York and Los Angeles police departments had special rap units. The New York and LA units trained police units in cities nationwide. Evidence supports that these units use murderous counterintelligence program tactics against rappers. While police maintain that they only kept lists of rappers for legitimate crime investigations, many on these lists experienced COINTELPRO-type attacks, such as Wu-Tang Clan members. Other New York police targeting included Sean P. Diddy Combs and Run-DMC's Jam Master Jay Mazelle. In the latter case, gunmen came into Jam Master Jay's recording studio and shot him in the head. Similar to the New York recording studio shooting of Tupac, police ignored a security camera videotape of the gunman. As they would regarding other murders of rappers, police stated that the murder may have been due to the East versus West rap war. In the late 1990s, Def Jam founding music mogul Russell Simmons organized the Hip Hop Summit Action Network, or HSAN. He appointed Sean P. Diddy Combs and other top rap industry figures, along with professors and politicians, to the HSAN board of directors. HSAN also came out with a 12-point political platform, not too dissimilar from the Black Panther Party's 10-point platform. Combs, a lead aide to Simmons on the project, came under attack after this project started. A gunman shot at him in a club, and New York prosecutors reportedly spent the most money ever to unsuccessfully attempt to convict him of a gun possession charge. Many on Simmons' Def Jam and Combs' Bad Boy rap labels also came under attack. For example, evidence supported that media and U.S. intelligence manufactured more fake rap feuds. undercover agents are the top suspects in then carrying out shootings that have occurred around those rappers. Police have arrested them for frivolous charges related to these incidents. Evidence supports that police intelligence have targeted many other politically linked musicians. A Senate Intelligence Committee's report on U.S. intelligence abuses included an intelligence memorandum on the targeting of political musicians, reprinted in Alex Constantine's The Covert War Against Iraq. Musicians targeted included Martin Luther King funder Harry Belafonte, SNCC supporters The Last Poets, Jamaican Socialist Prime Minister supporter Bob Marley, Rage Against the Machine, Spearhead, Dead Prez, Nas, The Coup, Mos Def, and Eminem, amongst others. In Los Angeles, the particular undercover police unit involved in Death Row Records went through the largest police scandal in decades, called the Rampart Scandal. An assistant state's attorney said that Detective Russell Poole's investigation sparked this scandal, named after the Ramparts Division in which the officers worked. Poole said that the investigation of the scandal actually turned into a cover-up of what he had originally uncovered, as Death Row Records police officers conducting murders, drug trafficking, and gun running. Death Row Records cop Rafael Perez was the state's top witness before lawyers found that he lied about his own drug dealing as well as his murdering of dealers to steal their drugs. It should be remembered that Perez worked in the Special Police Crash Unit that worked in conjunction with the FBI in operations following the LA riots. The Crash Unit was a Rampart unit, and around the same time, the Rampart unit came back into the news. A photographer spent decades trying to get back his film of Robert F. Kennedy's assassination from the Rampart Division's police unit in 1996, and the case finally reached trial that summer. A judge forced Rampart to give Enyart his roll of film, but Rampart said someone stole it out of a police car on the way to court. The Rampart Division was one of 18 Los Angeles police divisions. William Turner, a 10-year FBI agent turned journalist, and John Christian, a broadcast journalist for ABC News until 1966, did an extensive investigation. After 10 years of research, they wrote that Rampart worked to cover up the CIA assassination of leading presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy in 1968. Turner, Christian, and other researchers cited how 13 bullets were fired while arrested gunman Sirhan Sirhan had a gun that only carried 8 bullets. Furthermore, this picture of the official coroner, Thomas Noguchi, shows him at a press conference pointing a gun within an inch of the back of his head and describing from where the assassin fired the fatal bullets. Witnesses said that people grabbed Sirhan Sirhan when he was no closer than 2 feet in front of RFK. All evidence points to security guard Eugene Caesar, who worked for a startup security firm founded by a CIA agent. An associate of J. Edgar Hoover's said that Hoover disclosed that RFK's assassination was a CIA operation run by Robert Mayhew. As seen in this document, Mayhew worked as the CIA's link with Mafia. Martin Luther King family lawyer William Pepper said U.S. intelligence used Mafia to aid them with assassinations to provide them distance from the actual crime. Pepper detailed that U.S. intelligence contracted the Mafia to aid in MLK's assassination. Mafia aid was also suspected in the assassination of Tupac Shakur in Las Vegas. And few knew that the Mafia kidnapped guitar legend Jimi Hendrix for several days. Hendrix resisted Black Panther requests for financial help until Martin Luther King's assassination. By 1969, Hendrix dedicated his last album to the Black Panthers, spoke of the need for them in interviews, and discussed plans to start a radical political organization with other top musicians. U.S. and British intelligence appeared to collaborate against Jimi Hendrix. The FBI had Hendrix under regular surveillance. Hendrix's business manager, Mike Jeffrey, seen here, reported formally working for MI6, which is Britain's CIA. Hendrix suspected Jeffrey of sabotaging his attempts to do political benefits, as well as getting him arrested and sabotaging his career. When Hendrix tried to fire Jeffrey, the Mafia kidnapped Hendrix, and Jeffrey claimed to use bigger Mafia to free him. Within 48 hours of Hendrix finally firing Jeffrey, he died. In 2009, Jimi Hendrix's road manager said that a drunken Mike Jeffrey admitted having associates kill Hendrix. The hospital doctor who first saw Hendrix just after his death supported the road manager's statement. The doctor said that Hendrix appeared to be murdered. Hendrix's fiancée, Monica Daneman, said that Jeffrey and others threatened her life if she ever published a book manuscript on Hendrix's radical politics and government foul play in his death. Within a year of publishing that book in 1995, she allegedly committed suicide. U.S. intelligence also had it in for another black music icon, Bob Marley. The CIA supported a candidate running against Bob Marley's friend, the socialist Jamaican Prime Minister Michael Manley. Marley planned to do a concert supporting Manley just before the upcoming 1976 elections. A gang associated with the opposition candidate shot Bob Marley and his wife Rita. While the two survived, Marley's manager said that the CIA then came to Jamaica and poisoned Marley. Marley continued singing Stand Up For Your Rights and calling for revolution, but that poisoning led to the reggae superstar's early death in 1981. In conclusion, while evidence supports that U.S. intelligence has targeted leftist black leaders with genocide, harder economic conditions may bring a more widespread onslaught. The Progressive magazine published a feature story in 2008 stating that the FBI deputized 23,000 managers of top corporations to form a group called InfraGuard. The FBI said that members of this group could murderously shoot others without legal consequences. In these dire economic times, the bigoted super-rich murderers have expanded their scope.
You will not be able to stay home, brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on Detroit from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Green Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.